Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. First, I'd like to thank you all for coming out this evening, supporting your local and independent bookstore. Without you, these author events wouldn't be possible. So thank you very much for coming out. Tonight, I am so honored to introduce Corinne McCandless. I'm sure many, if not all of you, know her brother, Chris McCandless, and his tremendous story. We get to see a different perspective of him through Corinne's book. And really, it is a terrific book. And I am, again, so honored to introduce Corinne McCandless. Please give her a round of applause.
Hi. Thank you all for being here tonight. All right, I'm going to read from the beginning of chapter 9. And this chapter starts right after my oldest brother, Sam, and I returned from Alaska, where we had gone soon after Chris's death to collect his remains and the items that the state troopers had excavated from the bus with him. Sam and I returned from Alaska, accompanied by the mystery that was attached to Chris's belongings. No one was sure what to make of the items. Dad put every article, from the rifle to the journal, through a thorough inspection. His eyes focused with a detached concentration, dissecting the reasons why Chris would have possessed each one. Once his examination was complete and the display methodically organized, Mom walked around the table, touching each item gently. She brought them to her face, one by one, eager to attain some sensory connection to her son. Each family member who arrived at Windward Key approached the anthology delicately and took the time they needed. We hoped we would have more answers than questions after we developed the rest of his film. He'd been missing from our lives for more than 2 years, and the snapshots, photographs Chris had never seen, would tell us more about what he'd been doing. I held that first envelope of photos from the drugstore for a long time before opening it. As much as I wanted to see Chris in them, every image would remind me that I would never see him again, and my mind refused to comprehend it. I didn't want to, couldn't fathom, that I'd never see him in the flesh or feel his protective hugs. But just as his ashes were an unexpected comfort, as I sifted through the images, they too brought a smile that contradicted my tears. The first thing that struck me was how happy Chris looked. The contemplative, often angry face from our childhood photos was gone. He looked free, completely at ease. No one was forcing him to pose in front of the camera, to wear a suit or a smile. But he did smile. In fact, he beamed. I remembered that look from a time when we went to Colorado as kids and hiked at Long's Peak with our parents, Shannon and Quinn. Shauna had come along for the ride into the mountains, but opted to stay in the suburban, perfectly happy to prop up her feet and relax while reading fashion magazines. It had been an idyllic summer in the Rockies. We stopped for lunch at the beginning of the boulder field, a long and wide stretch of stone deposits left behind by the destructive path of ancient glacial flows. My brothers and I scrambled over hunks of sedimentary deposits of earth in every size, testing the stability before putting all our weight onto one, then moving on to the next. It was like an exhilarating puzzle. Chris and Quinn were determined to make it all the way to the keyhole before descending. Dad allowed it, but was adamant that they go no farther. The rest of us watched as the two brothers made their way up to the keyhole entrance and raised their arms triumphantly. They gazed through to the abyss for a short time before they scrambled back down to where the rest of us were enjoying the hard sun. The smiles on Chris's and Quinn's faces burned just as brightly. Now here was that smile again. In one photo, that appeared to be taken not long after Chris had left Atlanta. He stood thigh deep in rich Blue Lake waters. In another, he wore a straw hat, sturdy hiking boots, and a grin as the Sierra Nevada spread out behind him. A humorous shot showed him holding up a drink as he sat in a beach chair at the side of the road, looking to hitch a ride, and another was of some beautiful wild horses. But the picture that affected me most of all was one in which he stood on an open road with no cars, people, or buildings in sight. The exhilaration in his eyes and the gorgeous snow-covered mountain range that rose behind him left no doubt as to where he had been heading. Despite the images from the last stroll becoming more difficult to look at as I neared his final shot, those pictures told me what I'd known the whole time. Chris had left to find peace and happiness. He'd left a goodbye note among his possessions, thanking the Lord and saying he'd had a happy life. I didn't know everywhere he'd been, but despite the dissonance of emotions banging through me, I was glad he'd found what he was looking for. Otherwise, I was still in shock, wearing a false half-smile and trying to keep it together for my parents' sake. Compliant Corrine emerged full force, and it felt easier to just go through the motions. My mother gave me and my siblings the task of summarizing our brother's existence onto 4 poster boards for Chris's wake to be held the next day. Mom handed me a large storage box of old photographs without having had the strength to look through it herself first. Shelley, Shauna, Sam, and I dug through the memories, organizing photos by date, and thus began the exhumation of our childhood together. Board 1 was dedicated to Chris as a baby. "Well, here's the beginning," Shelley sighed, and handed me a small picture of my mother, dated in April 1968. Mom stood proudly in a bathing suit, holding Chris, a tiny, underweight 7-week-old, up for the camera. Shelley's lips tightened, and I knew why the photo upset her. While Mom was showing off her postpartum figure, Marcia had also just given birth to Shannon. An image of Marcia at this time, exhausted after her 5th delivery and under command of our dad, would tell a very different story from the one Billy was aiming for. "Oh my gosh, look at this one," Shauna quickly intervened with a giggle. "I forgot just how cute he was as a baby." She held up an 8x10 sepia-toned image of Chris, caught in what would prove to be a rare formal pose for the camera. He rested, tummy down, and the onesie he wore melded so perfectly with the white, puffy blanket that he appeared to have been inserted directly into a marshmallow. Chris had propped himself up on one arm to have a look around, his hand in a gentle fist just in front of his ear. His huge brown eyes smiled cleverly at the camera, while his lips appeared ready to say something well beyond his years. Board 2 was for early childhood and grade school. I picked one of Chris with me in front of a spindly Christmas tree. We were dressed for church, our arms wrapped around each other, our grins wide as we stood among the gifts Santa had left behind. I found another seasonal picture of us, this one with our parents, taken when I was just 1 and Chris was 4. On the back, in my mother's handwriting, was "Us at Beach Christmas Day, 1972, waiting for turkey to finish baking at home." I thought about how all our siblings must have felt that day, at home with Marcia, wondering where their dad was. I buried it deep into the not-for-wake pile. The next up for assessment was another picture taken at a beach. This was years later with several of our siblings at a waterfront house on the West Coast that Dad had rented for a family vacation. After the photo was taken, we'd all been locked out of the house. Mom and Dad were fighting inside, and an audience was not wanted that day, so we were forced to stay out on the sand. All Marcia's kids, who had inherited her fair complexion, burned terribly in the sun, and spent the rest of the vacation nursing huge blisters on their backs and shoulders. I found another picture of Chris and me. We were buried in a colorful shed of autumn foliage, Chris's hands entangled in Buck's fur. "We used to make gigantic piles of leaves in the backyard at the Angela house," I said, "and run into them again and again." My siblings smiled and passed it around so everyone could see. Board 3 was for high school and college. Sam found a photo of Chris standing on the high school track with Andy. It was picture day at Woodson, and the yearbook club photographers were out in droves. Chris was barefoot, running shoes slung over his shoulder. Both boys were posed for the opportunity, yet Andy's wide smile contrasts with Chris's pursed lips and squint towards the camera lens, as if the request to pause had interrupted something more important. Do you remember how he would wear that exact same shirt and shorts to running practice every single day? I asked Shelley. Hell yes, she laughed and wiped her eyes. I think that outfit could have run around the track on its own. Shauna pulled out a photo from Chris's high school graduation party at the Annandale house. God, I remember that night, I said. Chris was dressed like a young Tony Bennett and stood next to the piano where Dad sat. The party had been held under a big blue, white, and yellow tent on the back deck, and you could see blue and white balloons, our school colors, in the background. I remembered how Chris had sung Tender is the Night while Dad played the piano. Chris had an amazing voice, but when he sang, he always turned away, just slightly, almost shyly. But he wasn't ever nervous. He usually turned away so he wouldn't start laughing. He had an embarrassed grin he'd get whenever he noticed someone looking at him, and he wasn't always successful at hiding it. Number 4 was the board dedicated to the man we did not get to share experiences with, who'd separated himself from our painful past. This was the man who smiled on that open road, doing exactly what he wanted to do, what he needed to do. I wished I knew more about what he'd done and whom he'd met. But in the absence of that information, we did the best we could to put the fourth board together. Though Shelley was still in denial, she also recognized something in those last photos of Chris. She'd heard mutterings of how foolish he was to go off the way he did, with such limited resources to find himself. But she understood that she'd done the very same thing. She would never have dreamed of getting lost in Alaska, but had loved getting lost in New York, where she'd moved alone and with very little money. They had both been on a journey, and the thought made her feel closer to him. As we looked at the photographs, we didn't need to speak to know we all felt the same way. We mourned the loss of this strong, dynamic human being, and we also knew why he'd felt he had to leave so decisively. I believed that there was a part in all of us that wanted to march down the stairs and blame Walt and Billy for what they had done, for driving Chris to leave. But we couldn't talk about it. Not there. Not then. Throughout the rest of the afternoon, Mom alternated between being catatonic and manic. At one moment, I would see her sitting in a chair, alone, staring off into the distance, loneliness filling her face. Then something would snap and she would move about the house like a Tasmanian devil cartoon character, a swirl of nervous energy with vacuum and dust rags in hand, stressing over cleaning the townhouse meticulously before the guests arrived. Dad rearranged furniture. Then, after Mom stopped her spin just long enough for them to swap spats about placement, he rearranged it again. The stage was set for another show, one that none of us wanted to be in. Still, I was determined to say my lines and smile on cue. Although I could see the intense pain on my parents' faces, I could not bring myself to take them into my arms. To mourn and cry with them should have been the natural thing to do, but even the thought of it felt illusory. Those emotions only felt honest and cleansing when shared with my siblings, with Fish, or in quiet solitude. I was awaiting a sure reaction from my parents, expecting a breakdown and an apology at any moment, a request for forgiveness. I was certain the loss of their son would bring about this long-awaited change. I was grasping for anything positive in this devastating situation. They'll see now, I thought. They'll change. They had to lose a son to make this happen, but it will happen, and I can help make it easier for them. The wake played out as programmed. Friends and neighbors filed into my parents' home to make the rounds and give their condolences. They ate fine finger foods and lingered on the decks overlooking Chesapeake Bay. Unasked questions floated in with the breeze off the water and circulated amongst careful discussion. I was up in the loft at one point during the gathering and heard my mother's voice rise with a lift I had not heard in days. She wanted me to come down to see Chris's friend, Brian Paskowitz. Brian had been a neighbor on Willett Drive, a kind-hearted but tough kid with a bulky football player's build, noticeable especially next to Chris's slim runner's physique. While I was still in grade school, Chris and Brian went to Frost Junior High together. On every fair-weather day, after the bus dropped them off at the corner of Braeburn and Willett, right in front of Brian's house, the boys would sit in his front yard and practice their French horns, waiting for me to come walking home from Canterbury Woods Elementary. I would sit and listen for a while, and when it was time to go home, Chris would carry anything heavy I was lugging along with his horn. Though my memories of Brian were vivid, I hadn't seen him in several years. I ran down the stairs, eager to greet him. When I walked into the kitchen, he was on his knees, weeping hysterically. I tried to calm him with rehearsed words of reassurance that felt hollow on my breath, but his keening was inexorable. At that moment, seeing his raw emotion break out in the midst of my family's performance, I was forced to acknowledge that my brother really was dead. He was dead and never coming back. Not long after, several of Chris's college friends arrived, including a couple of guys I remembered hearing him mention, Josh Marshall and Lloyd McBean. Lloyd had been Chris's roommate and closest friend during his sophomore and junior years at Emory. Having them there was a welcome diversion. I brought them to the dining room to view the photographic display of Chris's life. I smiled and pointed to different pictures and shared anecdotes, giving a varnished account of their friend's life before they knew him. Lloyd followed directly beside me with an air of circumspection, listening to everything I had to say. He studied the photographs carefully. Then he raised his eyes, looked directly into mine, and with an expression that appeared to be wrestling sadness and anger, said to me slowly, "Chris would hate this." Compliant Corrine crumbled. Of course, Lloyd was right. Chris wouldn't have wanted to be memorialized this way, or perhaps at all. If he had, it likely would have looked much different. But for the day, I was an automaton, submitting Chris's very private persona for examination by many who had never even met him, on assignment from those who didn't even understand him. I noticed how many of my parents, neighbors, and friends were there, compared to people who really knew and loved Chris. I understood exactly what Lloyd was saying to me, and I envied his freedom to express it. The next morning, the poster boards were replaced with fine china and fresh linens. My siblings and their spouses remained at the townhouse with Fish and me. We passed the scrambled eggs, toast, and bacon in silence. Fresh fruit and pastries were piled up on silver trays. It felt wrong to have this abundance of food traveling across the same surface that 12 hours earlier had displayed images of my brother slowly starving to death. Mom didn't eat much. She stared at the plate in front of her and scattered the food around the edges. "I think the reception went very well," she said softly. "Absolutely, Billy," Dad concurred. "Everyone was so kind and forgiving of Chris for what he's done to this family," she continued. "Excuse me," I about choked on my eggs. "What did you just say?" My mother's eyes, wide and hurt, met mine. She was expecting pity. The compassion I felt the day before evaporated. I looked straight back at her and sternly asked, "Do you want to talk about why he left?" Then I turned to my dad. "Do you?" I knew my siblings were willing to have the conversation. That didn't mean we wanted to. We felt weakened, exhausted, sad for Billy and Walt, and for ourselves. But we all sat up to attention, ready to defend our fallen comrade if necessary. Mom didn't say anything. She just looked down and continued moving her food around on the plate. Dad acted as if he hadn't heard. There would be no battle today. The table fell silent again. During the first few months after Chris's death, I witnessed some changes within my parents that I was confident were reconnecting us in a positive way. Though I had questioned their motives in looking for Chris when he disappeared, their grief now was unmistakably real. My mother was losing weight, while my father gained. Their eyes were gaunt and tired. Whether or not they actually took responsibility for the loss of Chris, they were suffering. I was suffering, too. So I felt closer to them than ever before. At home one day, I received a call from a writer who identified himself as John Krakauer. He was working on an article about Chris for Outside Magazine and wanted to know if I would talk to him. I was conflicted about the idea. I wanted to know what Chris's life was like after he left Emory, where he had been, what all he had done, and here was a journalist willing to find some answers. But Chris had had a very private nature, and I feared him being exploited, which I was quick to inform John during our short interview. The cause of my trepidation, however, I did not explain to him on the phone that day. The article John wrote for Outside received an extraordinary amount of attention and generated more mail to their offices than any other article in the magazine's history. This was as much a surprise to John as it was to my family, which increased his already strong desire to explore Chris's story further. The next time I heard from John was in May of 1993. He had just made a formal agreement with my parents to expand his efforts into a book and asked if he could come to Virginia Beach to interview me at greater length. I was cautious. Since it was my parents who had granted him permission to tell Chris's story, I doubted that much of the truth would be told. I was also unsure how much should be shared. I still held out hope that my parents would see the error of their ways and regret the course of events that had led to a story at all. In the end, I agreed to at least meet with John in person. He was not very well known, and I didn't understand why he felt that there would be enough public interest in Chris's life and death to write an entire book about it, much less sell many of them. I doubted that anyone beyond our own family or the occasional reader of Outside would even pick it up. John Krakauer flew to Virginia to interview me at the new house Fish and I had recently finished building. Upon meeting him, I was struck with an unexpected sense of trust, of the kind that only comes from having years of history with someone. He seemed much like I would have expected Chris to be in his late 30s. He wasn't particularly tall, and he had a wiry, yet quite muscular build that he did not make any effort, visual or otherwise, to boast about. His hair was dark, like Chris's, though his eyes were lighter. Overall, though, his similarities to Chris were more internal. He had an inquisitive nature that seemed to be in constant conflict with skepticism. There was not much public information on John to be found. I had learned only that he was a literary, journalistic-style writer and an active outdoorsman, highly respected within the obscure world of first-rate climbers. Although John had a reserved demeanor, I could almost see the current of fervent energy flowing behind his eyes. The mystery surrounding my brother's story was one that seemed to intrigue him to a point of obsession, but in a very private way. He never asked me directly, but I could discern from John's questions that he believed there was much more to Chris's story than he had previously been told. He wanted to know about our family dynamics from my perspective. I recognized his intense quest for truth. At first, I spoke vaguely around the issues he was attempting to dissect, but this strategy did not last long. Not because I was unable to speak in soft circles around the specifics of our childhood. I had been doing that for years. But because, for the first time, I felt obligated to tell the truth. I had kept so much private, and even the notion of coming clean about our family history offered me a sense of relief. I trusted that John wanted honest answers for the right reasons. I told him about Walt's coinciding marriages. I told him about the awful fights, the manipulations, the violence. As I treaded into the unexplored territory of exposing the reality of our past, I became more and more comfortable with John. Resolute, I explained that truth was of paramount importance to Chris, and why that was. In Chris's own words, there was nothing more crucial to a pure and happy existence. I wanted to honor and do justice to Chris, and I felt I could only do that by describing everything in the most finite detail, telling John the whole story so he could represent Chris fully, even if not explicitly. John was grateful to my parents for allowing him to delve into the mystery of Chris's journey, and he was also sensitive to their pain. But I perceived an even stronger obligation within him to understand Chris and be fair to him. He was clearly not party to what I feared might be my parents' agenda. While I told him almost everything, I asked that he keep much of it private. I still wanted to protect my parents from full exposure in case they could change for the better. I wanted to spare my siblings from having to deal with the painful mess of our family history in a public way. We spoke about the delicate line we would need to define and walk together. He would quote me, describing my relationship with my parents as extremely good, and at the time, I hadn't stopped believing that it could be. Just as John was preparing to head back to the airport, I felt an overwhelming reassurance come over me. I decided to let him read Chris's letters, which I had never shared with anyone else, not my parents, not Fish, not my closest friend, not even my siblings. I would not let John make copies or take any photographs of the letters. He was restricted to handwritten notes only. Shortly after reading the first letter, the others spread out on the table, awaiting their turn to speak for Chris. John's mood became anxious. His eyes darted across Chris's impassioned handwriting, then back to his notepad. I knew he would need time to digest what he was reading, and that there would be hours of discussion ahead. I invited him to have dinner with Fish and me and stay in the guest room for the night. His acceptance was understood as he quickly rescheduled his flight and informed his wife Linda of the change in plans. Before handing over the letters, I made John promise that he could not include anything from them in his book without my approval. And even as I said the words, I felt that they had been unnecessary. I sensed a deep respect from him, and that he was very aware that having my trust was his key to truly understanding what had made Chris tick. I had given the author of the story, Chris did not live to tell, the enormous responsibility of knowing the truth, yet not writing it. Thank you very much. So I'm open to any questions that you all may have. I'm used to working with students all the time. I lecture where Into the Wild is required reading. It's in 3,000 high schools and colleges across the U.S. So I'm going to say, tell me your name, because I'm used to asking students to tell me your name. I'm exposing myself completely, so you've got to at least give me your name. You can use a pseudonym if you want. Nobody will know. So just raise your hand, any questions that anybody has. Their students have a ton of questions. Yes, ma'am.
Maria.
I'd
like to know what compelled you to write the book?
What compelled me to write the book? Well, it's a good question after 20 years. I just felt that the time was right. It came to a point where I couldn't not do it. And, you know, I want to say that my parents deserve a lot of empathy, of course, for losing their son. And they certainly didn't do everything wrong. We had, I wouldn't say a safe house. We didn't feel safe necessarily all the time, but we had a beautiful house to live in, and we never had to worry about where our next meal was coming from. And, you know, a beautiful yard, and we had opportunities. They introduced us to nature, which was an amazing gift, and they taught us a very strong work ethic. And, you know, we were able to pursue, Chris and I, our musical interests and our athletic interests. And I know as a parent, those things aren't always easy to provide for. But with credit where that's due, it doesn't negate the devastation, the detrimental effects of the devastating things that happened within our household. And Chris's story is a very powerful example of those devastating effects that domestic violence can have on children and their families. And in speaking with students, which I opened myself up to the last several years, I realized that not having the whole truth, truth was so important to Chris. And with so many blanks that were left and all the why questions that were lingering from John's book, which is an amazing book, and he did an incredible job really portraying Chris in a way that he related to so well and in a very honest way. I'm able to give a personal insight that really explains Chris to people outside of that iconic figure he's become. You know, he's more humanized. And I think that you can learn lessons from humans. And my parents are no different than that. You know, my parents are not villains. I wrote this book with truth as my guide and pure intent in my heart. And I know that there are some very important lessons that can be learned from our story. I will say that I've spent 20 years waiting for two particular people to learn those lessons. And I don't want to speak for them because I don't think it's fair, but I felt that it was extremely important to not, I felt that I was doing a disservice to Chris, to my family, and especially to all of those around the world that I hear from every day now that seek inspiration from Chris. Because just as you can't learn from villains, my parents aren't villains, they're humans, and you can learn from mistakes, but you also can't necessarily learn from mythical figures and iconic figures. And when Chris is more personalized for the students, I saw how instead of it just being an assignment for them, it became a lesson that they took with them outside of the classroom. And these are the children, they're at this age of opportunity, and they're going to be the partners, the husbands and wives of tomorrow. They're going to be the parents. They're going to be the people that make decisions on how they're going to live their lives. They're at an age where they are deciding who they're going to be and building that foundation for who they're going to become. And I felt it was very important, and I felt that it was something that Chris would want me to do. So it took 20 years and a big fat book. That's the shortest answer I can give you. Sorry. Next question. Yes.
Kevin.
Hey, Kevin.
Did you ever have that conversation with your parents about why he left? If you did, what was your reaction? If you did, what do you think?
I did have the conversation with my parents. I did not share Chris's letters with my parents simply because Chris was very angry, and rightfully so, for some of the things that he went through in his childhood. And I talked to them about the letters very directly, because Chris did tell me that he was going to leave after college graduation. He told me he was going to disappear. He quote, you know, I don't speak for Chris. I think nobody should, but I do relay in my book, and I'm very careful to say if it's something that I'm relaying because I believe I understood him so well. If it's something that he told me directly or if he wrote to me in a letter, I'm very clear about that in the book. And I did talk to them about it several times. And you'll see there's, and I don't want to speak for my siblings either, but I can tell you from my perspective, I'm the youngest of eight children. And I saw each of my siblings ahead of me kind of go through this push-pull. And you'd get to these points where you would have these really wonderful conversations with Walt and Billy. And I say Walt and Billy not to be impersonal. My other six siblings, their mother's name is Marcia, and so I never want, it's complicated sometimes. It took like two or three chapters to work that out in the book. So I'd say Walt and Billy not to be impersonal, but so people understand we have the same father, but a different mother. So you would come to times where you would have this moment of clarity and peace, and you would think, they get it, and here we are, and it's this beautiful thing. And then the next conversation, it's like it never happened. So there's a lot of denial and a lot of what I would call manipulations of truth. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that I felt I'd done a disservice to Chris and to my siblings, and I take responsibility for that. I also feel that I did a disservice to my parents, because if I had been strong enough at that age to talk more openly, perhaps the blanks that were left after John's book wouldn't have been easy for them to fill with assumptions that sort of rewrote the past. And my mother used to talk to me on a daily basis about how she wanted to be a voice for women that were, for battered women and children in that situation. And she wanted to help those people. And unfortunately, she wasn't strong enough to do that for herself or for Chris and I to get us out of that situation. And I'm not sure that she'll see it this way, but, you know, there's a very strong lesson in her in this book. And I think that that will help a lot of women feel empowered and make different choices. So their reaction pretty much has been denial. And it's not surprising to me. It doesn't anger me. It's something that I expected. They never really did understand the damage that they were doing to their son or to any of us. Yeah, so in fairness, that's what I think I should say there. Yes, ma'am. Hi, Sally. You'd like to know the reaction of my siblings to the book? Okay.
And your parents as well. And they're still together?
Billy. Walt and Billy are still together, yes. Well, my siblings, I don't want to speak for my siblings. There are a couple whose voices are pretty strong throughout the book. Shelley and Shauna, hopefully they don't mind me pointing them out, but they're here. And that's Shelley. Shauna's sitting there. Shauna's the one with the fashion magazine sitting beautifully in the back. And Shelley's the one in the back going, yeah. So you'll get to know them a little better when you read the book. Love you, ladies. So I don't want to speak for my siblings. I will say that it's important for me to point out that every one of my siblings gave me their trust and respect. And they understood that I felt that I needed to do this. Not all of them were happy that I felt I needed to do this. And although they gave me their trust and respect, you know, they asked that their presence be in the book from a factual standpoint, and they were fine with that. But I tried to respect each person's distance and comfort level as far as how much of their voice I brought into the book. I think something that I've learned in writing this book, although I knew before, but especially in kind of, you know, I choose not to live in the past, and I always thought that meant I couldn't revisit it. And I learned in writing this book over those 3 years how important that is. I begin the book with a quote that says, I'm going to misquote, so I'm not going to say who the quote is, but those who... refuse to acknowledge the past are doomed to repeat it. So it's George Santayana. So if I got that right, thanks, George. But I've learned how important family is and how extremely lucky I am to have the family that I have. Yes, Shauna, do you have a question or a statement? Oh, she's saying, yeah. All right, sorry. Okay. Did I answer your question? My parents' reaction, they did. I haven't heard from them personally, in all fairness. They did release a statement to the press that described my book as fictional writing. But again, I'll just defer to the statement that I said before. But in fairness, yes, that is what they have said. Thank you, Sally. Yes.
Hi, Linda.
I
actually graduated from high school with Shauna.
Oh. As far as the movie's concerned, see, I'm remembering to repeat the question now. how accurate was the movie? How involved was I with it? And my parents. Okay. So they had to be involved as far as the legalities of John's book being turned into a film. And I was hired as a consultant on the film, and I worked as a script contributor on the film. It was about a 2-year process. And my relationship in that with Sean Penn was similar to that with John Krakauer. I wanted him to get it right, but I wouldn't let him say much or show much in that avenue. There was a little bit more, if you remember in the film. There's a scene of violence, and I wrote that scene. And, you know, I wanted there to be a little bit more, honestly. And I write about that in the book. Not to say you have to buy the book to read to figure that out, but it's, I don't have that much time, and they close the store at 9. But yeah, to go into all the details that I wanted to go into sort of made the movie take a whole different tack. And then the movie became about Walt and Billy and not about Chris. And I decided that Sean Penn knew a little bit more about making movies than me, so I kind of deferred to his judgment there. And I'm pleased with the film. You know, there's a couple scenes in the movie, only two in the whole thing, that I wasn't as pleased about. And I write about that in the book as well. One was, it kind of leaves the impression, as it doesn't say it directly, but in the narrative, it leaves the impression that perhaps we didn't know our brothers and sisters very well growing up. And I'll give that to my father and Billy as well, even though the methods weren't always like I would have hoped. They did make sure that we all knew each other and spent time together, and we spent summer vacations together, and that was a wonderful thing. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Madison.
Hi, Madison.
I have a similar question about the music, that Eddie Vedder's music and your relationship with it, and how, you know, how that was involved in this process of writing the book and healing or not.
Right. How involved was I with He does know a little bit more about making music than me. All right, I have an answer for you. All right, so I was really involved with talking a lot to John when he was writing the book. Didn't need to help John write a book, obviously. So not saying that. But I just, you know, he was so great at talking to me and sending me samples of things and making sure that he was walking that boundary that I'd asked for. And I have the utmost respect for that man. He's amazing, and his trust and integrity is incredible. And in a very different way, but same thing with Sean Penn. Sean had called up Eddie, because they're friends, and said, you know, he had taken, and I don't want to speak for Sean, but I'll tell you what he told me. He had decided on, initially it wasn't going to be one voice through the whole film, but then he decided that's what he wanted. And Ed came to his mind first. And yeah, good choice. Sean knows what he's doing. So Ed is someone that I cannot say enough kind words about. He has been so wonderful to my family, to my brother, to his memory. All these years later, he's still dedicating songs to him at concerts. He doesn't have to do that. And he means it honestly from his heart. He's an amazing man. So I wasn't involved at all, pretty much. What I'll say is that I heard the soundtrack after it was done, and I had met Eddie before at one of the viewings of the film, but we really didn't talk. I was so focused on the project, and it's like, yo, that's cool, Eddie Vedder, whatever, you know. I was working on something else. So I waved, talked a little bit. But after it was done and I heard the soundtrack, when I first read the complete manuscript that John had sent to me, the first thing I did was call him and say, it's amazing you never met him. I said that same thing to Eddie. What I said to him was, it's incredible to me because the words that you have written, these beautiful lyrics, it's as if I'm sitting there listening to Chris talk to me. So yeah, it was, I think that there was a lot of involvement there, but it wasn't from me, if you get my drift. And I do write about that in the book. I don't want to speak for Eddie. He told me some pretty powerful stuff, but yeah. So, yes. And what is your name, ma'am?
Beth.
Beth the Great.
So I'm wondering, in your art of hearts, do you think that Chris fully intended to come back and was his biggest mistake, just having not enough food?
In my heart of hearts, do I think Chris intended to come back? Absolutely, 100%, no doubt whatsoever. And I am very straight up. If I thought he intended to go out and die in the wilderness, I would say that. But I can tell you 100%. That was not his intent. And there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of things that back that up, even though I don't feel I need to prove anything. I didn't write this book in defense of Chris, but it's very obvious in some of the things that aren't known yet of some of the belongings that were found with him and his wallet that actually was in his backpack and his birth certificate and his social security card, those things. And there's pictures, and we talk about that in the book. But Chris loved life more than anyone else I've ever known. But when I work with students, just as I think it's so important that you can learn so much from Chris and his successes, you can also learn from his mistakes. And I will say that people like John Krakauer and other people that are similar to John as far as in their, you know, these extremists and these adventurers, I've heard them sit around and have conversations about how they have this respect for Chris. Now, they can have that respect while acknowledging some of the carelessness that he had and some of the mistakes that he made. But Chris was young and male. Being honest here, it's called the wild truth. And, you know, I sense in these people that have more wisdom and experience are now older, and I hear them, you know, and John's even written about that. They're amazed that they made it out of some of those things alive. So they remember when they were Chris, you know? And I think with age comes that wisdom and that experience. And when you're younger, you're in male, especially. Not that us women aren't a little crazy sometimes, not me, but that boldness kind of blinds you. But I think that's the point at that age. And, you know, Chris was very smart. And he was good at everything he tried to do. So in order to make it difficult, he had to really push the bar. And I want to say, too, I do not blame Walt and Billy for Chris's death. Chris made mistakes, and he decided to put himself in some precarious situations. What I hold him accountable for is his disappearance, the way that he had to completely break free and had to denounce Chris McCandless and become Alexander Supertramp and had to cut off all ties. That's a very different thing. And I explore all those things in the book. So I hope I answered your question, Beth. Yes. Julie?
What do you think Chris would be doing now?
That's a really good question. Am I allowed to say who you are? Julie went to high school with us. No, that's another Julie. Chris apparently liked girls named Julie. Very beautiful girls. And this beautiful blonde in the background was one of them. And she was faster than him on the track as well. Yeah. So I'm asked this question a lot, and I always have the same answer. I think Chris would be a lot like John Krakauer. And every time I say that, John Krakauer blushes. You know, and both of them are of this character that I don't think they understand how remarkable they are. And Chris didn't understand. I mean, you knew him. But I think that Chris... And, you know, I hate to speculate here, of course, but I think that Chris would be a teacher or a professor. Chris was a really good writer, so I think he would be a writer of some sort, perhaps. And I often would see, I would think of Chris as a journalist, and one of those journalists that would go out and make a name, but not for himself, but a name in undercovering, you know, uncovering human rights atrocities around the world. And he'd probably would have been jailed or abducted and, you know, all those kinds of things. That's what I, you know, in his spirit, that's the kind of thing that I think Chris would have done. And I also think that he would have found a really cool chick that would have been able to put up with this kind of stuff, maybe a little like John Krakauer's wife. And if Chris had become a father, I think he would have been an amazing father. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm so sorry. Have I held on to his memorabilia? That which I have, yes. My parents have some. I have some. I think, you know, I don't feel, and I don't want to speak for my siblings, I don't feel that any of us feel that we need to have his things to feel close to him. But I will say, in writing the book, I do write about receiving his backpack after 15 years. That was so incredibly powerful. And even though it's a thing... It's a thing that was with him on all his travels, and holding it in my hands was pretty powerful, and smelling the smells, and yeah. And you, yes. the courteous man to the left. Hi, Jackson.
I'm also someone who has taught in for a while. It's got an enormous draw for people. And I think that your brother's story has become part of American mythology. He's on the shelf with Thoreau.
Yes.
How has seeing him that way as sort of this mythic figure, this sort of saint that we have, how have you thought about that over the years as the John Krakauer book on Book as a movie came out and you saw the draw that that story had on people?
All right, so Jackson is a teacher, and in his students he sees how Chris is sort of looked at as this. And I would assume, depending on your students, usually, you know, they're kind of in two camps. They can admire him or admonish him. They think he's brilliant or they think he's an idiot, which, by the way, wouldn't bother Chris either way. No disrespect, but Chris was concerned about what he thought about himself, and he died at peace because he was at peace with the choices he'd made in life, and he accepted responsibility for the mistakes he had made as well. And in the end, I think that's the best that everyone can hope for, is to have that peace. But students oftentimes do, and people say from John's book, and it's not everybody, but people do sort of have this, you know, idyllic view of him, this mythological view. And, you know, what I would say to that is, you know, John got it right. I mean, John does, he doesn't talk about Chris in the book as if he's perfect. He doesn't. Chris inspires a lot of people, and he does every single day. I talk about how I think Chris would have been a teacher if he had lived, but Chris is still a teacher in his death. And, I think that, you know, John was able in Into the Wild to share a side of Chris that, frankly, I couldn't. You know, John related to him as a young male, an extremist, an adventurer that took great risks. John has written about how he had his own charged relationship, father-son relationship. And, you know, I'm able to give a different perspective that, as I said before, kind of humanizes Chris a little bit more. So, I think that this just adds to John's book and doesn't take anything away from his portrayal of Chris. Chris is a deep enough of a character and a man that you could probably write a couple more books about him. And I'm a little biased, but I'm also honest. Did I answer your question well enough, Jackson? All right, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
I'm just a little confused about your dad. He was married to Marcia?
Yes, ma'am.
So was he abusive with that family as well?
Yes, so she's asking, because it's a little confusing, and you're right, it's a little confusing about the two families and our ages, the last four children, the ages are all intermixed. You know, it's really hard in a short context here to get into that because it took two or three chapters in the book to really explain it. But what I'll say to that is, imagine growing up as a young child with that and how confusing that is. And it all comes down to truth. I mean, my father, you know, he was manipulative and deceptive to my mother, Billy, when they met. She was aware that he was married. And so while she knew that she was a mistress, and I need to be honest about that, he was very manipulative about his and deceptive about his relationship with Marcia. But, and again, I don't want to speak for my siblings, but, you know, factually, I can tell you that there was domestic violence present in both households. In my household, my mom was the primary target. And at times it spilled over to Chris and I write about that. And I think that what I want to say and try to say without crying, and I also don't want to speak for Marcia, but Marcia really comes through this book as what she is, which is an amazingly strong woman. And she was able to take her six children out of that situation without the financial opportunities that my mother had. And she's the reason I have a family today. When Chris and I were growing up, through the violence and things that were happening in our household, and we would watch our mother suffer through this, and she would apologize to us and say, "I'm sorry, but when I got pregnant with Chris, I got stuck with your father. And when you're a little 6-year-old boy, you take that on as this is your fault. And that's a lot of pressure to put on the shoulders of a little boy. And as we were growing up, that continued. And as we got older and we started understanding through sex education class how it is that children come to be born and what it means that we have another brother, his son to Marsha, that's 3 months older than Chris. I mean, all those things, and you have these questions, but they're never answered. They're woven and woven and woven and woven. And it becomes a very difficult, untrusting situation. And it goes down to truth. They made mistakes. That's okay. I made mistakes. I write about it in the book. I can't call other people out for the mistakes they made and the lessons I want to be learned from that without being self-deprecating and showing the mistakes and bad choices that I've made and what I've learned from that. But I learned from Chris that nothing's more important than truth. And the other day I was at Stevenson University in Maryland, and a student asked me, and it's because of something I write towards the end of the book, and a student said to me, "What is your line between forgiving and not forgiving?" And my answer came out immediately, and very short, surprisingly so. And it was honesty. It's all it takes. You know? I think that lessons come from learning from those mistakes, and learning comes from honesty. But I often think back to Marsha, and when you look at what Chris and I were, and what we represented it as, these children from an affair at a very difficult time in her life, she taught her children that it wasn't our fault. We were their brother and sister. And while as I want to give credit to Walt and Billy for certainly involving us all in each other's lives, there was also a lot of blame put in there amongst all of us. And sometimes, once there's unity of siblings, where that's a beautiful thing, sometimes people want to sort of divide and conquer them, because with that comes truth and strength. And Marsha never did that. So, next question. Yes, ma'am. Hi, Jen. Yes. Yeah, so you're talking about, there's like a 14-minute video that's posted online on YouTube. Well, there's one, so there's two, there's a video, there's a short video that's like the book trailer, and then there's a longer video. And so I hiked into the bus in May of 2014. The first time I went to the bus was with John Krakauer in 2007, which was via helicopter. August, not a good time to go to the bus, not safe. I hiked into the bus in May of 2014, difficult hike emotionally and physically. And, you were asking about the river crossing, the Teklanika River. Claire Ackerman passed away. Yes. And was drowned. Yes. Yes. Right. Has access to the bus changed? It hasn't. Hopefully the education about getting to the bus. I mean, I want to say, I do a lot of work, and there's a man named Eric Halfacre that does a lot of work and has a site called stampedetrail.info. And he is from Alaska. He's a young man, and he works very hard to put information out there. If people are going to do it, he doesn't encourage them to. In fact, he usually encourages them not to, because he puts his phone number on there. Sorry, Eric. But he really, it matters to him that people do it safely if they're going to do it, or they decide not to do it if they shouldn't. And, it's a fact that there are a lot more people needing rescuing in Alaska that aren't on their way to see the bus. But that being said, it's not about the bus. It's the story. I mean, people, if the bus gets removed, people are still going to go out there. And, in October of 2014, Shelley and Shauna went with me to the bus, which was an unbelievably powerful and beautiful experience. And we went by helicopter. Again, it was not a safe time to go to the bus, to hike to the bus. So I'm sorry, I'm kind of guessing what your question was, but the education about getting back and forth has grown, and I'm hoping it will continue. And I'm glad that you saw that video, because in the video I do try to show we did cross. It was a group crossing, and the majority of the people that were with me were from Alaska and helped my butt get safely in and out. I'm a girl from Virginia. I do a lot of hiking in the Shenandoah. It's not the same. Right. I mean, it was in the spring. We're in a chain doing a group crossing. And let me tell you what, my editor, this beautiful, wonderful woman named Jenna Landfree, was with me as well. And she's this petite little thing. And I could feel her, you know, we were locked and I could feel the current, picking her up. And yeah, it was low. It was still swift, but it was low and very cold. Yes. Next question. Yes, sir. Hi, Greg. Do I feel a sense of pride, relief, and closure for getting? I feel responsible. I feel a responsibility, and honestly, it comes so much from working with students, because when I'm talking to them and I give the rest of the story, it's like watching all these light bulbs go off, and it's oh. And then I hear from their teachers and their professors and their parents. I mean, Into the Wild has been required reading for so long that I've got parents coming to the events and the lectures because they read it, you know, when they were in school, and now they have kids in school reading it. So, yeah, it's just, there's so many powerful lessons through it. And, you know, I had kind of already come to terms with everything before I decided to write. I don't know if I could without doing that. I'm proud. I am. I know a lot of people have different reactions, and with all due respect, similarly to Chris, I care about how I feel about why I did this, and I'm proud of the reasons I did it, and I'm proud of the support that I've had from my family and friends, and most of all, honestly, from Chris. I felt that he was with me while I was writing this. Absolutely. Thanks. All right, one more question. Who's got the... Yes, Patty.
Did Chris ever contact you or write you a letter on his journey? Because I thought if he contacted anybody, it would have been you.
That's my Aunt Patty. So Aunt Patty asked, did Chris contact me after he began his journey? And then she very sweetly said, which I'm going to just go ahead and throw in here, that she felt that if he was going to contact someone, it would have been me. No, Chris wrote to me several letters, and we talked in depth about how he was going to leave. But I knew once he left Atlanta that I wouldn't hear from him again. And oftentimes when I work with students, I do get the question, weren't you just pissed that he didn't send you a text or an email or something? And I suppose it's because I have to look like I'm 105 for them to not understand that we didn't have a cell phone. I hold up the cell phone and I say, we didn't have these. And they look at me with this horrific look in their eyes, you know. But, I mean, I got it. I understood exactly why he had to leave that way. I often get asked if I'm angry about it, and I'm just not. I understood. I understand. I think many of my brothers and sisters do. And not speaking for them, but just from my conversations. And so one of the last things he said to me is that he would come back and find me, because I had left home as well, and was in a situation where I was not in contact with Walt and Billy for that period of time. And he just said, "I'll find you." And honestly, every day I came home from work, I expected to see Chris on my porch. So the day that my husband at the time came home and told me that I was never going to see Chris on my porch was like telling me there wasn't going to be oxygen in the air the next day. It was tough. But he didn't write me a letter or any contact after he left on his journey. But I have heard from him. Thanks. Okay.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.